From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. You might not know it, but even if you're just waking up, you've probably already used a service from one of the big five tech companies. Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. They are so ubiquitous, their reach and control of our digital lives so complete that it's impossible to live without them. Or is it? Can you really, truly, completely cut the big five out of your life? Now, I'm not just talking about deleting Facebook or moving to Proton Mail or unplugging Alexa. I'm talking about not interfacing at all with all of the hidden services that these companies provide and profit from. Is it possible? Or are the monopolistic powers of the big five so complete that we simply cannot live without them? And if so, what does that mean for us as individuals, our society, and our economy? This hour on Point, one Gizmodo reporter tried to block big tech from her life. Here's what happened. And you can join us. Could you live in a world without Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, or Microsoft? Have you even tried? What happened? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and, yes, Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from San Francisco is Kashmir Hill, deputy editor for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo. She did a six-week experiment blocking big tech. It's chronicled in the series she's written. It's called Life Without the Tech Giants. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Kashmir, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, I want to ask you, what possessed you to even try?
Well, you know, there are a lot of critics of these companies these days that say they're too powerful, they're too privacy invasive. And when you raise these concerns, the response is often, well, if you don't like the company, then don't use their products. And so I wanted to interrogate that question. Is it possible not to use their products? And I found that it is not possible with most of the big tech companies.
Yeah, the TLDR is no, it's not possible.
No.
but I want to actually hear the whole story here. And first of all, start off with how you went about doing this experiment. Because, like every interface I can think of, every digital interface, you're probably going to touch one of these companies. So how did you bubble yourself away from them?
Right. I didn't just want it to be an experiment where I boycott their products, where I stop using Amazon.com or, delete my Facebook account. That's something that's been done before, and it's not really the question I was trying to answer. I wanted to understand all the invisible ways that we interact with these companies, too. So I worked with a technologist who built a tool for me, a virtual private network or VPN, that prevented my devices from connecting to the tech company's servers. Mm-hmm. So that meant that not only did Amazon.com not work and WholeFoods.com not work, but any site that was hosted on Amazon Web Services or AWS, it wouldn't load for me. So it wound up taking down a lot of services over the course of the experiment.
Yeah. I mean, basically, a lot of the web just blinked out of existence for you. And we're going to talk about Amazon in a few minutes, because I think it's the one that, for people who don't know about all the web services they provide, it's a surprise. But I actually wanted to start with Facebook. And full
Everybody
disclosure.
Everybody always wants to talk about Facebook.
Well, first of all, I want to put out a full disclosure here. I have a sibling, a brother, who is a product manager at Facebook. So full disclosure there. But the reason why I wanted to start with Facebook is because it's the one I think that people are most now habituated into hearing, like, it's going to invade your privacy. But when you tried to cut yourself off from Facebook, how did you do it, and what happened?
So the way that this tool worked that I was using, the technologist I was working with, Dhruv Mehrotra, got these lists of all the IP addresses or internet protocol addresses that the tech giants own. So for Facebook, it was about 120,000 IP addresses. Mm. And so we just blocked them off. So Instagram wouldn't load and Facebook wouldn't load and WhatsApp didn't work. And I also decided, I have thought for years about actually deleting my Facebook account. And I'm always resistant just because, I've been building that thing since like 2007 and I have all these connections and, I've written that people who aren't on Facebook are suspicious and may not exist. And so it was hard for me to take that leap, but I decided, okay, I'm doing this experiment. Let me just delete my Facebook account entirely. And so these are the ways I separated myself from Facebook for the week. And the one thing we did with the VPN, we wanted to try to capture how often my devices were still trying to communicate with the servers of these tech giants. So yeah, like how much data they were trying to get from me or trying to send to me. And over the course of that week, Facebook was kind of pinging my devices over 15,000 times. So that was probably like trackers around the web. And, you know, Facebook has something called Facebook Pixel, which is this code that a company can put on its website so that when you look at like a particular shoe, it registers with Facebook that you looked at that shoe, and that company can retarget you, you know, on Facebook with a picture of that, with an ad for that shoe. So those kinds of things were being blocked for me over the course of the week.
And then, if I remember correctly, also something as basic as like endless pinging for notifications for posts that you hadn't been reading on Facebook.
Yeah, the funny thing. So before I deleted my Facebook account, I went in to check to, you know, see if there's anything, you know, I missed before I delete it. And I had like over 30 notifications. And I thought, wow, did something in my life, you know, blow up? Like, yeah. What's going on here? And I went to check what all the notifications were. And something like 24 of them were about one friend who had left a comment on a post I had made a few days earlier. And so basically, like every few hours, Facebook was adding a new notification saying, hey, you know, Hillary left a comment on your post. And it was just 24 notifications about the same thing.
Okay. They're like, come back to us. You haven't entered the Facebook world in a while.
This is absolutely something I've been seeing a lot on social media, that Facebook, and probably listeners right now have noticed this, that Facebook is starting to give us notifications for things that we most of the time do not care about, and it's not anything like directly relevant to us. It'll say like, oh, a friend posted this photo, or there's some new thing happening in an event page that you're in. And they're, I think, just trying to create more notifications to try to get people checking the site more.
Well, so I want to be clear that you, in this 6-week experiment, for the first 5 weeks, you blocked individually one of these companies, right? So Facebook on 1 week, Apple on another, Google on another, et cetera. And then at the end, you tried to do all of them at once.
At the end, I did all of them.
Okay, we'll talk about that. But so what was the effect in your life of not having Facebook?
So I thought that Facebook would be kind of a nice break from social media. And I didn't think it would be that hard. But and it was technically easy to block. Like our blocker worked, which wasn't the case with all of the tech giants. But it was way harder for me to let go of Facebook and its suite of apps than I realized it would be. Because I thought, oh, I don't actually use Facebook that much. I'm kind of obsessed with Instagram, and I use that all the time. I love sharing photos and stories and seeing other people's photos and stories. But I miss both of them. Like, Instagram's kind of one of the time waster things I do on my phone when I'm standing in line or I'm bored, and I missed it, being able to go there.
Yeah.
And Facebook, so that when I was doing this experiment, this was in the fall, and I was blocking Facebook the week of Halloween. So I like didn't get to see what all my friends were dressed up as, and I couldn't share photos of my adorable 1-year-old dressed up as Boo from Monsters, Inc. But it was also the week of the election, and I really wanted to know what my friends were saying about like how they were going to vote on local propositions in California. And I was sad to miss that. One of my closest friends had her baby, and I didn't find out until days later when I re-enabled my Facebook account, and it was one of the first things that popped up in my newsfeed. And I called her up, and you know, I said congratulations, but I wouldn't have found out about this without Facebook. And she said, "Well, you know, if I post something on Facebook, I just assume everyone I know sees it," and so I was cut off from the ability to get and share news with my wider community.
Yeah. Okay, so this is why, I mean, I wanted to start with Facebook, because I think it's the one that most easily people can connect with, because, you know, feeling that emotional loss or that social loss is very familiar, or the concern about that is very familiar. So that was Facebook. But what was interesting about that is in terms of your access to being able to do the things that we just presume are normal parts of daily life right now, when you cut Facebook out of your life, you didn't lose that access. But, so can we move to Amazon here for a second? Because
sure.
Cutting Amazon out of your life was an entirely different story because of all the things they do that maybe we don't see. So tell us about Amazon, cutting Amazon out.
I mean, it was impossible to fully block Amazon for my life just because they're so woven into the infrastructure of commerce and the web. So I decided, okay, you know, I'm not going to order things on Amazon.com, which I usually do a lot. And
yeah,
I
you admit
to get
that
one.
You and your husband have individual Prime accounts. Come on.
Yeah, we've both been paying Amazon over $100 a year. This story, a lot of people email me to say there's something called Amazon Prime Household, and you and your husband don't need to be paying for separate Prime accounts. So tip for listeners. I was like, okay, so we won't use Amazon.com this week. That's easy. But we needed a doodad for our car, one of those like plastic phone holders that you attach to the air conditioning vents.
Oh, put your phone in. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And usually I would just immediately head to Amazon for that. But I couldn't this week. So I went to eBay and I ordered it. And a couple of days later, I'm checking the mailbox and I have, one of those yellow Amazon Prime envelopes with the smiley arrow on it. And, you know, Amazon is just so dominant in the world of shipping and storing that even its competitors are dependent on it. So they have, you know, fulfillment by Amazon, and a lot of eBay sellers store their goods in Amazon warehouses and use Amazon services to ship. So, you know, that was one of the ways I couldn't avoid Amazon.
Well, we have to take a quick break here, and we're going to talk about the other big way that you couldn't avoid Amazon when we come back. You're listening to Kashmir Hill. She's deputy editor for the special project desk at Gizmodo. And she did this 6-week-long experiment about whether or not she could block the big 5 tech giants completely out of her life: Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Apple. And it's basically impossible. So that raises a lot of questions, not just about digital privacy, but about monopolies in 2019. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Kashmir Hill. She's deputy editor for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo. And she did this really interesting experiment. Over the course of 6 weeks, she tried to block the big 5 tech giants out of her life completely: Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Apple. And she wrote about what happened and whether in this day and age it's even possible to do that in this terrific series called Life Without the Tech Giants. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Okay, so Kashmir, we're talking about Amazon now and your attempts to cut the yellow banana smiley out of your life completely. And just to remind folks, you did this by you had someone help you build a virtual private network, or VPN, for you to use to where all your web traffic or digital traffic would go through. And this VPN...
Right, I connected all my devices to it, and the VPN just basically blocked my devices from being able to talk to the servers of the tech giants.
Okay, so the IP addresses owned or associated with these tech giants.
Exactly.
So how many IP addresses does that mean you could not get from Amazon?
So Amazon controls over 20 million IP addresses.
Is that a lot?
It's a lot. I mean, there's billions of IP addresses available. Amazon, both Amazon and Microsoft actually own a lot of IP addresses, over 20 million, compared to Facebook, for example, which only look to be operating 120,000 of them.
Okay. And so why is it? This has to do with Amazon Web Services. But why is it that Amazon has all of these IP addresses?
So when most people think of Amazon, they think of Amazon.com, the retail giant, and maybe Whole Foods, the, you know, grocery store that they recently bought. But the most profitable part of Amazon is AWS, or Amazon Web Services. And it's something that the company launched about a decade ago when it had to build the service for itself to host its data. And it has just done gangbusters growth. It was a really smart business move. And Amazon is now hosting the websites and data for apps for so many different companies, so many different services. It is a behemoth. And again, this is the this part of Amazon is way more profitable than its Amazon.com and its retail services.
So you call the Amazon Web Services a vast server network that provides the backbone for much of the internet. So were we talking about things like, you know, everything from I don't even know if maybe our own website. Oh, I'm getting a yes. Yes, our producer is shaking her head. Yes, like on the OnPoint website relies on Amazon Web Services. Some government websites as well.
I mean, most government websites. It's kind of why I think Amazon chose the DC suburbs for one of its 2 second headquarters, which I find confusing. And Gizmodo Media Group itself, all of our sites are hosted by AWS. They are the giant, just the giant of web hosting, and host the vast majority of sites out there, followed by Microsoft in a distant second.
Okay, so Netflix is sending its content through Amazon.
Which is surprising, right? Because Netflix is a competitor with Amazon for, you know, new video series, and they're competing for customers. But Netflix is dependent on Amazon for its web hosting.
Okay. So what are the implications of this? I mean, individually for you, one of the implications was obviously, okay, there are vast swaths of the internet all of a sudden you couldn't have access to. But I'm wondering on the flip side, and this is a question that, you know, tech observers and legal observers have been raising, Amazon Web Services and Amazon's hosting of all this data means that they have access to it, right? How are they using the data?
Yeah, so the problem for me is that, it took out vast parts of the internet and especially all digital entertainment. I just, like, couldn't watch movies or TV or listen to music. We have an Amazon Echo that we use to play Spotify. And I could have still listened to Spotify because it's hosted by Google, but we didn't have a way to play it in our home. But yeah, the problem is, so it's Amazon just increasingly is kind of running the rails of physical shipping in the world and then digital shipping in terms of shipping the data that the internet provides. And it makes them very powerful to have so much control over that market. You know, it means they don't quite have a monopoly, but they're certainly getting there. And that means if you're not happy with their service, you can't really go elsewhere. And one of the examples of that, so one of the things that was blocked for me was Signal, mm-hmm. which is an end-to-end encrypted messaging app. You can do calls and texts. And I use it a lot with sensitive sources, but also just with my friends, with my husband. And it uses AWS. And I was surprised by that because about a year ago, AWS was going to kick Signal off of its platform because Signal was basically disguising itself in order to remain active in repressive countries where the existing regimes, you know, didn't want people to be able to communicate privately. And Signal just stopped doing that because it felt like it didn't have any other choice besides being hosted by AWS. So without an alternative, it had to comply with Amazon's demands. And other ways we've seen Amazon use the data it sees flowing over AWS is that a few years back, Amazon was able to look at startups that were doing lots of traffic and attracting lots of users because they were looking at their network and saying, wow, they're, you know, using a lot of data essentially. And so they decided to invest in those startups. So it gave them an eye into those startups' businesses. And that's a pretty like innocuous use of that data, but you could imagine more troubling uses in that it can see into its competitor Netflix's metadata to some extent.
Wow. Okay. So this is one of the reasons why for Amazon, some people have been raising this question about whether is it a modern day monopoly?
People have definitely been raising those questions. And I felt, I mean, that's something that I explored in this series. And I read this kind of a blockbuster academic paper, blockbuster for academic standards by Lena Khan, where she talks about the fact that she thinks that Amazon really is already a monopoly, but that antitrust law hasn't kind of kept up with it or has evolved away from defining things like Amazon, which are pretty good for consumers in that they're, you know, offering cheap goods and cheap services, such that it's good for consumers. So they're not seen really as a monopoly.
Right.
But I, in my experience with seeing just how dominant Amazon is, it made me certainly sympathetic with the concerns that Khan was raising in that paper.
Well, so this is one of the critical things about how we think about or should be thinking about the big five tech companies in this day and age, because, you know, as you just said, and let's underscore it, the traditional view and the sort of regulatory view of a monopoly is it's bad as if it starts harming consumers. But, you know, as you said, like Amazon is providing all of these services that currently are a benefit to consumers. So people are saying, like, what's the big deal? It might be a monopoly, but maybe it's a benevolent one. Maybe it's one that's that's enhancing the quality of our lives. Look at all that you can do because of the existence of Amazon Web Services. I mean, after your experiment here, Kashmir, do you feel like that's a is that a legitimate excuse, or do we really need to rethink sort of what a monopoly is in the 21st century?
I would say the latter. Yeah. I mean, so I always think about the real world. And in the real world, the government has a kind of monopoly on providing, you know, public infrastructure, roads and highways and schools. They kind of have a monopoly on these things. And on the internet, which is still a pretty new thing, like the internet's only really been around for a couple decades now, a few decades. It's these companies that have built the infrastructure. And that became really evident to me during this experiment, that I just kept running into them because they have built the roads and the highways of the internet. They offer so many services, or that basically like kind of any business that has an online component is dependent on them. And so we have this weird place, this public space where we're all spending more and more time that is controlled by tech giants instead of by the government. And we just don't have the same kind of, you know, civil liberties against private companies that we do against the government. And so I think we really need to examine this, because it's just kind of developed on its own in a kind of haphazard way, because the internet kind of just developed and surprised us. And I think now's a good time to look at what's happened and think about what we do about it so that these companies don't become so powerful that we can't stop them.
Right. And just to put a little coda on your experiment of trying to block Amazon from your life for a week, you found that it was impossible.
Yeah, it was. So it was impossible because of things like the eBay story I told you, but also because when you do stories like this, you confront the physicality of the internet. It's not just vapor in the air around us, like clouds running, raining down data. So my blocker was blocking my devices from talking to Amazon servers. But some sites are hosted on Amazon servers. They're hosted by AWS, but they'll employ a secondary service called a content delivery network, or CDN, that helps their website kind of load faster. The CDNs basically have like more servers and around the world instead of like Amazon's vast ones.
Yeah.
So it's like getting your data from a local store instead of from the warehouse. And so sometimes my blocker, if it would see the CDN in front of Amazon's, you know, huge AWS warehouse, it would let that data to my phone. And so AWS is kind of like hiding.
It's like
hiding
in there. Amazon coming to your house. Okay. Well, let's go.
So
to,
in those cases, I couldn't block it.
Let's go to the phones really quickly. Let's go to Carmela, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Carmela, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna.
Hi. So what do you think? Have you blocked the big tech giants from your life in any way, Carmela?
Well, I went on a year-long social media sabbatical, so I was blocking Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all of those. And I found a lot of freedom in getting rid of social media, and it forced my friends and I to actually have like more meaningful communication, because I couldn't pretend to know what was going on in their lives because I didn't have this superficial world of social media filling me in, and vice versa. My friends, I noticed, were reaching out to me more and asking me, like, what's going on in your life? How are you? And so that was like a nice aspect of the social media sabbatical. Also, like your guest, there were some downfalls. I missed out on some things, including a good friend of mine like passing away and didn't find out much later. And so that was upsetting. But it was pluses and minuses.
Yeah. Well, Carmela, thank you so much for your call. So Kashmir, I mean, you heard Carmela say pluses and minuses there. People are always drawn back to this question of, you know, social media, right? Because it's the one that we all understand. And I get it. Pluses and minuses. You were saying that, like, you ran outside instead of on the treadmill for you know, for a while because you couldn't watch Netflix while on the treadmill, and that you actually managed to take in your pieces, you read about you're on the airplane with your little child and you can't give her an iPad to watch videos. I'm like, everyone's like, oh no, there's a child without entertainment on the airplane, but you survived. So there's a positive side to this.
It's funny. My husband didn't do the block fully with me because he said he had a real job and couldn't stop, you know, using the internet as it's intended. So he was begging me. We had a flight to New York from California on the last day of my experiment. And he was like, please end it early. We need to use the iPad. And I said, no, I want to stay strong. And so, you know, I read books to my daughter and we sang songs and we played with a little toy and she slept for the last hour and a half. And we landed and we are in the taxi. And my husband turns to me and says, that was the easiest flight we've ever had with her.
It was a miracle, quite frankly. Now, listen, I want to encourage listeners to understand something. We're not just talking about social media and cutting, you know, Twitter or Facebook Instagram out of your life. What Kashmir has been experimenting with is how deeply embedded these five tech companies are in almost every aspect of our digital lives, and how we can't see that. That's why we spent a lot of time talking about all that Amazon Web Services, all that traffic on the internet that it's mediating that we don't think about or don't know. And so that's why, Kashmir, can you talk to us about Microsoft? Because I think that's one where, you know, in thinking about the big five, folks may not actually think of Microsoft right off the bat anymore the way they did in the 80s or 90s. So, you know, what is Microsoft mediating for us now?
Right. Like, well, I think we had a lot of people had the same concerns about Microsoft back in the 1990s. But in that time period, regulators actually decided to act, and they said Microsoft's a monopoly, and they went after them. I found that today it was mostly so. It's complicated. So Microsoft owns, you know, Microsoft Office and Microsoft servers and Windows and Skype and LinkedIn and Xbox. And I was able to avoid those things because I'm an Apple user. And it was possible to go a week without, you know, using Skype or LinkedIn. But in the real world, Microsoft servers are all over the place because they were just such a dominant tech giant for so long that you have businesses that are powered by Microsoft servers. And, you know, the public transportation system here, BART, I noticed after the experiment ended, actually, that I was seeing Windows error messages on some of the screens. So I think a lot of government services depend on them. So
you were seeing Windows error messages on the screens on the BART trains?
Yeah. So I think, like, when I, you know, fill up my card, my Clipper card, and when I pay, I'm using Microsoft.
I see. Okay.
So just as Amazon was hard to avoid online, Microsoft was hard to avoid in the real world.
All right. Well, I just want to play a little clip from one of the videos that accompanies your series, because as we mentioned earlier in the hour, you worked with a technologist, Dhruv Mehrotra. And, you know, you talk about how you initially didn't think you used that many Microsoft products because you're living a Windows-free life, but that the businesses that you visited did. And Dhruv explains how the company's data collection isn't exactly voluntary.
It's not like choices that you could individually make that would stop Microsoft from getting your data. It's like just by virtue of being in a city or like using, I don't know, walking around, you're encompassed into their software.
Kashmir, just by walking around, you're encompassed by Microsoft software.
It's true. I mean, most cities, and it may well change, you know, Amazon, Google, all these companies that were able to thrive because of the antitrust challenge of Microsoft. Now they are challenging Microsoft and trying to build the technology that powers cities.
Well, Kashmir Hill, stand by here for a moment. Kashmir is deputy editor for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo, and she recently underwent a special project where she tried to block the big five tech companies out of her life completely, tried to block Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Apple, and basically found out it is impossible. So, question for you, listeners, what is the implication of that? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Kashmir Hill. She's deputy editor for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo. And she did this very intriguing real-life experiment where for 6 weeks she tried to block the big five tech companies completely out of her life, Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Apple, to see what would happen or if that's even possible in this day and age. We've got a link to her series about that. That link is at onpointradio.org. Oh, and Kashmir, I keep saying this word, that link is at onpointradio.org. The one really interesting thing about your experiment is you talk about how we're living with the language of links and that you were really cut off from even accessing information that your friends sent you because people just send links all the time.
Yeah, I experienced this a lot when I was blocking Amazon because, I would ask people questions like, where do you want to go for dinner? And they would just shoot back a Yelp link, and then the Yelp link wouldn't work. I asked the technologist I was working with. I was just talking to him, Dhruv, and he was like, oh, yeah, I'm working on this. And he sent me a link to a motherboard article, and it didn't work. And that just kept happening to me. We use this shorthand communication now where we just have this common reference system of the web. And I was deaf for weeks at a time.
Yeah. So, just to underscore something, you write up in your series about how why this matters is that some 60% of your digital interactions or the information that's sent from, you and devices that you use through the internet is somehow touches just these five companies. And that's for just you as an individual.
Right. Yeah. On a daily basis, I send about 2 million data packets out onto the internet. And 60% of them are going to one of those five companies.
Right. So it's the consolidation of their access to that information, which I think is really what you're getting at, is why we need to care about this. But let's go to the callers. Let's go to Michelle, who's calling from Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. Michelle, you're on the air.
Okay, this is maybe a little, thank you for taking my call. This is maybe a little off, but the only way you're going to separate yourself from Amazon and all this company is not having a computer for 10 years, as myself, and have a dumb smartphone. Somebody put a security code in it, and I don't know what it is. But you can't get away from the key. You buy an appliance, and when you open up the registration, it tells you to register it online, mm-hmm. and it gives you no other alternative. Anytime you're doing post anything, they want to email you, and they get kind of upset when you tell them that you have to, they have to use the telephone. And the other thing is, everything is on the computer. Everything is sent to you via email by banking statement. They were charging me $3 a month because I had it sent hard copy on paper.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and there was other things. If you asked for something to be sent to you on hard copy, you know, like they would charge you. I did get the bank to stop charging me the $3 because I'd been with this bank forever, and they said, "Well, yes, we will, and please let us know as soon as you get a computer." You're just out there. I mean, everything is online. You got register thing. Talk to people. It's ridiculous.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate that. Michelle, basically trying to live a digital free life, finding it impossible. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Detroit. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
So far, so good, eh? my comment is this: I tried to live without social media or digital interaction, and I eventually gave in when I realized that people did not shun the telephone when it was new technology. People did not shun electricity or washing machines when it was new technology. I just kind of accepted that that's the way of the new world.
Ah, so does that mean that you've surrendered, or does acceptance equal surrender, or are you happily accepting this?
Happily accepting, I would say. It's just the way it is. I mean, when I was a child, we had black and white televisions. Nobody has a black and white television anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Joe, thank you. Oh, so first of all, let me just say thank you to Joe for calling in, but go ahead, Kashmir.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe. I actually love that you talked about phones, because phones are a good example of a place where we have seen worries about monopolies and the companies were, you know, broken up into baby bells years back. And phones are also a place where we do have a lot of freedom, in part because government intervention. Mm. You know, you can, with your phone number, you can call anybody else with a phone number. You don't have to be on the same phone carrier. It's not, if you have Verizon, you can't only call other people with Verizon phone numbers. You know, it's an interoperable system, and you can take your phone number and move it to a different company because the government intervened. There was a time, you know, when phone companies, once you had a phone number with AT&T, if you wanted to switch to Verizon, they said you have to get a new phone number. And the government intervened there and to protect our freedoms to use this technology. And so that's a really good example of, yeah, where the government actually helped protect us against the power of companies that had a lot of power over us. So I just think that's a good one to think about.
Well, so let's continue on that train of thought, though, Kashmir. Are you saying that you feel that the government needs to move in the direction of intervening with these companies now?
I mean, my job as a journalist is to point out where there are problems, and luckily I don't have to come up with the solutions. But I do document in this series of stories that there are a lot of critics that are saying, Hey, government regulators, what are you doing? Because these companies have become so big and so dominant. The five companies combined have bought over 400 companies and startups over the last decade, and they faced really no scrutiny in the U.S. from antitrust regulators. And you know, the one that everyone talks about now is that Facebook should never have been allowed to buy Instagram, that was really a consolidation of the, you know, the social media market. So I definitely talked to them, and I raised their concerns in the stories.
All right. So we will once again direct people back to the link that we have at onpointradio.org to your stories. Okay. So can you give us a glimpse, a little tease into what happened the week that you tried to block all five of them at once? Because again, just to remind folks, for the first 5 weeks, you did one company at a time, but then you went whole hog. What happened?
Well, the life of the woman who called in about her bank statement problems, that sounded very familiar to me. Apple and Google have a duopoly on the smartphone market. So I couldn't get a smartphone. I had to go back to using a dumb phone, a Nokia 3310 that has T9 texting, which a lot of people probably don't remember, but it's like...
That was like the first phone I ever had.
Yeah. It still has the snake game, I'm happy to report. And, it, you know, you use number buttons and you have to do predictive texting and press 1 3 times to type a C. So texting was very frustrating for me. And so I did a lot of phone calls, and I was planning a trip to South Africa for a story I was working on about digital mapping, and websites weren't working for me. So I couldn't book the trip online. And so I had to call a travel agency and book through travel agency, which is nice. It was nice to talk to people and they wanted to know about the trip and had fun conversations, but it was more expensive and way less efficient to plan the trip. A lot of silence in my life because I, you know, couldn't use these companies. I didn't take many photos because my Nokia had a terrible camera, and I had a, you know, a Canon digital camera, like a point and shoot camera, but without anywhere to share the photos, I kind of just stopped taking them. So I don't know. It was a difficult week in many ways, not having mapping apps, very, very hard. But it was also good for me. It was like the digital equivalent of a juice cleanse, where I got to grapple with some bad technology habits I have, and just staring at screens too much, and it broke me of those habits, and I feel technologically healthier after having done this experiment.
So, point taken, and you know, the idea of like doing a digital cleanse is speaking to my heart, Kashmir. But also, what you described sounds like, you know, going back to the 1980s or the early 1990s,
maybe the 90s.
But the 90s, I guess. Yeah, because you had a cell phone, even though it was a dumb one. But I think I also just want to ask you one last question, though, to the bigger point of what your series is. You might have been able to survive that week without the big five. Great. But you also were cut off from some things in the modern world that we actually consider essential for modern living, right? And so I keep coming back to that these five companies are in control of our access to essential aspects of how we live today.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I maybe I could have tried to keep blocking the tech giants for some period of time, but I mean, I couldn't do my job. I couldn't keep in contact with good contact with people I need to be in contact with professionally and personally. And since the experiment ended, I've gone back to using a lot of the services offered by these tech giants. And I do think it's unavoidable, which is why I don't think it's a matter of we as consumers fixing this problem. I do think we can be more intentional about our tech use and try to resist some of the bad stuff that they're pushing at us. But I think it's a larger problem that requires legislative intervention or a real change in the technology industry to offer us, you know, more options and more competitors and, you know, people who are trying to protect our privacy and not get us addicted to screens and staring at them as long as possible every day.
Well, Kashmir Hill, deputy editor for the Special Projects Desk at Gizmodo, her week or 6 week long series, by the way, is called Life Without the Tech Giants. Go to onpointradio.org to find it. Kashmir, it's been such a great pleasure to talk with you. Totally fascinating experiment. I'm glad you did it and I didn't have to. Thank you so much for joining
us today.
Took
one for the team. Thank you for having me on.
All right. So in the last couple of minutes of the show, though, I wanted to switch gears a little bit to talk about another big tech story. This one, it has to do with Facebook getting in trouble for a deeply invasive technology that they deployed. They got in trouble for Apple for that. We'll talk about why. But Facebook pulled back, but then reskinned the technology, redeployed it, and then paid teenagers to use it, which means that Facebook had the keys to everything contained in the teenagers' phones. Well, Josh Constein, editor-at-large for TechCrunch, broke this story, and he joins us now from San Francisco. Josh, it's good to have you on the show.
Hi there.
Okay, so your story really caught a lot of attention from people in the tech world. I wanted to inform more people about it. So first of all, what is this technology or this app that Facebook initially got into trouble with Apple? What was it? Why was it problematic?
So Facebook was releasing this app called Facebook Research, and it was a secret program under the name Project Atlas that was designed to recruit people aged 13 to 35, so that includes teenagers, and pay them $20 a month in gift cards to install a VPN and give Facebook root network access to their phone so that Facebook could look at everything they do on their phone, all of their web traffic, for competitive intelligence, so it could figure out what apps to buy or to clone. But this was really frightening to people because it involved teenagers who didn't necessarily know how much of their privacy they were selling.
Okay, so they got in trouble with Apple for that because it was the app was accessed through through Apple's App Store.
So the problem here was that Facebook used the Apple Enterprise Certificate Program, which is supposed to be only for distributing apps to employees, the kind of internal workplace tools you wouldn't want in the App Store. But because Facebook was doing this, Apple never had to review this app like everything else that goes in the App Store. And Facebook was distributing this to teens who were definitely not their employees. I'm pretty sure you can't pay employees in gift cards. And so Apple got very mad about this, and Facebook actually claimed that it was completely in line with Apple's policy when we first asked them about it. But 7 hours later, Facebook had to take down the app suddenly, and the next morning we learned that Apple had forced it to do so.
Okay, so here's the really interesting thing about this story, is that Facebook had tried this once, right? It gets in trouble with Apple, and that they took down the app, but then Facebook redeployed it, right, with barely making any changes. I mean, the analogy that I was seeing on Twitter was, you know, someone said Facebook got its hand caught in the cookie jar, then puts on a fake mustache and puts its hand back in the cookie jar. So they redeployed this app all over again?
Exactly. Last year, Facebook was deploying an app similar to this in the App Store officially, but Apple changed its policies and basically forced Facebook to remove it. But we discovered that a ton of the same code mentioning the exact same name of that app, Onivo, was found in this Facebook research app. So it was obvious that they knew that Apple didn't want this kind of app in the App Store, and they deployed it anyways. And that's why people like Senator Blumenthal said that wiretapping teens is not research and it should never be permissible, and saying that Facebook has a complete disregard for data privacy. And when you mess with Tim Cook, you're going to get burned. Apple did not take kindly to it. And what happened next was actually really surprising.
So what happened next?
So because Apple deactivated this Facebook research app, it also deactivated all of Facebook's internal employee tools. So that meant its workplace chat tool, its workplace collaboration tool, but also its lunch menu and even the schedule for its shuttles from San Francisco to its headquarters.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So a major spat there between Facebook and Apple. But Josh, so the bigger issue here, though, is, I mean, you used the phrase that Senator Blumenthal said about wiretapping teens, and that Facebook, it seems from your reporting, is so brazen in putting this technology back out there, paying teens, what, $20 a month to give essentially, perhaps they didn't know it, but complete access to their phones. I mean, hearing this, it sounds like just once again, Facebook just kind of like ignoring all the concerns people keep raising about their approach to privacy.
The company has a deep inherent problem with misreading public perception of its practices. The company actually told me that there was nothing secret about this program, even though it never announced it. There was no Facebook help pages or blog posts about it. It used intermediaries to run the program under names like Project Atlas and Project Kodiak. And TechCrunch actually discovered that Facebook had threatened to sue users who actually revealed or talked about this publicly. It's so clear that Facebook was trying to do this secretly. And I really think we're going to need to continually look closer at this company's practices.
Well, Josh Constein, editor-at-large for TechCrunch, he broke the story headlined, Facebook Pays Teens to Install VPN That Spies on Them. We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Josh, thank you so much, and thanks for your reporting.
My pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.